something there.
Do it.
About 10 minutes. Good evening. Is that working? Bonsoir. Good evening. Yes. Yeah, it's fine. Thank you. Welcome for this second evening. It's not working? Okay, I'm going to try to put it. Good evening. No, that's better. I have a lower voice, maybe. That's okay, so it's a pleasure to welcome you tonight. We're going to start. I know that we have a lot of people which are still registered that are coming in. And in fact, what we'd like to do is Marla Schuster, who is one of the volunteers that really helped in this video that we had, will come and give you an update of what's happening with this. And it will give you 3 minutes of listening a bit of music. Pop up the pace, and then I can do my little speech later on. So if Marla is around, where is she? Oh, sorry, Marla. So I'm going to try to put that in. You have a few things you want to say. So.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for joining us tonight. We're going to screen the video, McGill Dances for Cancer, and it was a group of dedicated scientists, research and doctors, students and volunteers who got together for a full weekend of dancing and recording this video. And we had several reasons we wanted to do that. We wanted to highlight the Goodman Cancer Research Center. We wanted to raise funds for the center. We wanted young people to take an interest in science. But most importantly, we wanted to give hope to cancer patients. And I think you will agree when you watch it that it is so uplifting and fun. You can go on YouTube or the McGill website and just search for McGill Dances for Cancer, watch the video, and please forward the link to everybody you know, because every hit raises very important dollars for the center. And to date, we have over 325,000 hits. Thanks to all of you.
That's a bad start. I knew I was not going to be able to do that. Okay. Let me see if I try again. If not, Marla, you have to sing the song.
I came to dance. I hit the floor, cause that's my plans. I'm wearing all my favorite brands. Give me some space for both my hands. You, cause it goes on and on and on.
going. No, that's good, actually. Keep going. Keep doing that.
So thank you for those which I've seen this many, many times. We apologize. But it's still a very good memory of that weekend that we had. And certainly a very important time at the center. So let's start a bit our evening. First, I'd like to, there's a few people in the room I'd like to mention, which are very important. First, I'd like to welcome Betty Aldridge. Is she around? Betty, will you stand up, please? She's chair and member of the board of National Pancreatic Cancer Canada, and you're joining us from Ottawa. I very appreciate it. You take the time to come, and this is very important. We have also tonight Andy Chabot, who is the executive director of the Cancer Research Society. Andy is right there. Andy, welcome. Is Madame Lutterman here with you? Please stand up. Fran Lutterman, which is also my English is always big. Fran, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Fran Lutterman is part with all our friends, part of, and I'll talk a bit about the projects. We were funded by the CRS and the Lutterman Fund a bit later. But thank you. It's wonderful to have you here, and also from the Pancreatic Cancer Canada. So I'll start by doing a few things. I'll try to get my slide going. Let me see. A few slideshow. Okay. People happy. We did that, I think, with the video. We'll go on. So we have already one evening done, which was in October 18, from chaos to quality care. We talked about that. Really was to start the three other evenings where we're going to have this academic year. And we learn about tumor banks. We learn how important patient contribution to cancer research was at the last evening. So tonight, we have two other sessions on March 13 on lung cancer and May 13. I think it's a mistake I made on melanoma. So you're invited to come and join us. This will be just before the spring, just to warn you about the UV and the tanning salon or the beach. April 24th. So I'm sorry. This I took directly from another slide. I don't think I can change. April 24th. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So I apologize for that. So I will be speaking a little bit, less is better, about things that we're doing in the center, also on pancreatic cancer. But we have two wonderful speakers tonight. First, George Zogopoulos. George is an MD, PhD. He got his PhD at McGill. He's MD at University of Toronto. George completed his clinical trainings at U of T in hepatopancreatobiliary surgical oncology. You could have made it a bit easier, you know, but I'm glad you're here. And he just joined recently the surgery staff at the McGill University Health Center. But we had a very special arrangement with the MUHC and George. George has his lab here at the Goodman Cancer Center, and he has his clinic at the MUHC. He will do also clinical research at the MUHC. He's going to be almost everywhere. And his main preoccupation is also pancreatic, hepatic, and biliary malignancies, but tonight he'll be speaking on us on the clinical sides of pancreatic cancer, and he has a long and interesting story to tell you. So, but also the dessert of the evening is Miss Libby Znaimer, and I'd like to thank you, Ms. Znaimer, to come tonight. I didn't say Libby yet. I didn't have long introductions yet and a glass of wine, but I'll still be very polite and still call it Mrs. Znaimer. So, Ms. Znaimer is a prominent Canadian journalist specializing in health, the arts, and lifestyle issues. I'm not going to read all of this classical radio that you've done, but she's also working as a print journalist. With Associated Press in Tel Aviv, she moved into television at Global Television and KSTP-TV in Minneapolis and WNBC in New York. You can see I didn't read as all these things. But most important for us tonight, Libby is a survivor of pancreatic cancer. She's active in a number of cancer-related causes. She's a national spokesperson for Pancreatic Cancer Canada and the co-captain of Team Zoomer. Are you going to tell us a bit about that? I'm not sure what that means, if you have 2 seconds, which raises funds for the Princess Margaret Hospital Foundations. So thank you very much again to be here. And I'll go on with my little talk, and we'll have our main speakers talk later on. So this is the evening of tonight. I've mentioned George. This is not your most recent picture, I believe, but we will update that. He has a few gray hairs since, I think. This was from the site of your colleagues in Toronto. You don't know that, but Webb has many pictures of everybody. And this is a very nice picture of Libby. Thank you. I'm not sure if you sent that or we picked it up. I think you sent this one. So it's a wonderful picture of you. So I did all my things without the slide. I apologize. So now let me talk a bit about, very briefly, the reason why we were very interested in pancreatic cancer here at the Goodman is for different reasons. But one of them is we started to work with the Terry Fox Foundation initially to recruit patients in different cancers. Particularly pancreatic cancer were the ones that we got here at McGill University. And what we wanted to do is really touch three different things which are very important, pancreatic cancer, which is very different than other place. So I didn't put my picture. You've seen enough of myself a bit earlier. I put Bruno Gagnon and Neil McDonald, two clinicians, who have applied to a grant from the Rob Lutterman Ski for a Cure and the CRS. And this is a grant that they're giving every 3 years to team in Canada. My understanding from George is that he was also an applicant that year. But so the life is good because now we're working with George anyway, so I think it's fantastic. And so the grant that we had was to touch three different things on pancreatic cancer: diagnostic, metastasis, and cachexia. And the reason why this was very important for us is that there's many difficulties with pancreatic cancer in terms of research direction. The first one is really the difficulty in diagnosing pancreatic cancer, and we wanted to do something with a few ideas that we proposed. The second thing is the highly metastatic properties of the cells which are coming from pancreatic cancer. When they're there, they're growing. They're also very metastatic, very unique in many ways. So we had also a few ideas. And the rapid development of wasting syndrome, we started with that group looking at loss of weight in cancer patients. And pancreatic cancer were, again, special in that sense and very difficult to deal with. So I'm just going to have three other slides, and then I pass by. So first thing is we recruited 70 pancreatic cancer patients here in Montreal. And this is incredible when you think of the difficulty of this disease and how these patients, which often are extremely severely sick, were eager to participate in this recruitment. The difference in the studies was that we had blood at every time they came to visit the clinic. So it is a longitudinal studies where we could use blood from these patients and look if markers were coming, if new development in wasting syndrome was coming. So we had also all the clinical assessment. I just want to, first thing we've done now, we've analyzed many blood samples of all these patients, and we've looked now at cytokine metabolites coming in. A few of the things we found, for example, IL-10 is a cytokine produced by cancer cells, and this cytokine is very much present in pancreatic cancer patients according to our database. We need to do more. We need the help of George to verify if this is going to be true, but certainly it is one of the directions that we're taking up in early diagnosis. We also look at, we knew in terms of metastasis, and you see this a little video here, but it's hard to see, but we have one gene which is very highly present in pancreatic cancer, and that gene does confer metastatic property of cells. So we're hoping that it will give us few ideas to block metastasis through that gene. On top of that, in the projects that George will help us do, and in fact it's he will do much more than that at the MUHC. We will take tumor samples from patients, not only blood, and do all sorts of things. Analysis by histology for different markers, generation of tumor cell line from these patients, and also looking at the cells themselves, how they react. So it will be an immense resource for pancreatic cancer across the country, and this will be shared with many people in Toronto and other places. And hopefully this will help us to target different genes in pancreatic cancer. So this is the second aim of our project. And the last aim is the story of losing weight. Already we look at many, many patients, and it was not obvious, but people thought that every patient with pancreatic cancer would lose weight. It turns out, if you look, this is very interesting. These are our women which have pancreatic cancer, and they do lose weight. They do go into wasting syndrome very rapidly. Surprisingly, men don't do as well. And they fare normally better, but they're still sick. They still very often pass away from this disease. So the way that women and men, even in pancreatic cancer, respond to this disease is very different. So these are things that we are also looking, and we hope that with the increased number of patients and the analysis we're doing, we'll be able to do a much better work on that. And I see Peter Mitrakos there. Hello, Peter. Welcome. So Peter is also the boss of George on the other side of the MUHC, so we welcome you. So this is a bit what I had to do, just to tell you that we do a few things here at the Women Cancer Center. We hope that we do more things with George and the group and Peter, and that's about it. So money well invested from the Lutheran CRS, hopefully, and we have more projects coming from Pancreatic Cancer Canada, I'm sure, which will be great. So thank you for this few little things. I'm not going to take questions. I think I really want you to have more time with George and Libby. So what we decided is George will talk first and Libby after, and we'll have questions on both of them at the same time so Libby can protect George when he cannot answer the questions. I think that's very important. And on top of that, after that, Libby offered very generously to sign a few books, although we don't have so much time, but she will take a few times at the end. So again, thank you for that. So, George, it's your turn. Nice ties, by the way. Nice tie. This is good.
So do I hold this, or do I...
You can put it in. You can put it in. I think normally, if you remember your young days here.
Young days here, I was sitting right on the... Where Peter Mitrakos is standing right now and avoiding being asked a question. But thank you... It's a very awkward microphone. One of the things we have to do is invest in a new microphone. But thank you. Yeah. I feel that I'm caged. I'm going to have to hold it. Thank you, Michelle. It's very nice to be able to speak on pancreatic cancer, particularly in the month of November. The month of November is pancreatic cancer. The month of November is pancreatic cancer month. I hear, I see people nodding in the back, which means it's working now. Is that right? Great. So thank you, Michelle. It's also nice to come back to this auditorium where I sat in the back row for many years and avoided being asked questions. And maybe I'll do the same tonight at the end of the talk from the front of the room. I'm perfectly fine. So what I thought I would do is highlight where we are with the management of pancreas cancer with a specific emphasis on the surgical management, highlight what our advances have been on the oncology side of things, and then talk about some of the research and where we'd like to go here, not only here at the Goodman, but also across the street at the MUHC and with and abroad as well in Canada and also internationally. Where is the pancreas? So I asked my mother, what should I tell everyone about pancreas cancer? And she says, why don't you start off by actually telling us where this gland is located? You keep on talking about it, but I have no clue where the gland is. So I said, the gland is really a fish. This is the mouth of the fish, and this is the tail of the fish back here. And it's located in the back, close to the spine, just behind the spine, and it's in close proximity with many other organs. And what I've saved you from here are the blood vessels, the major blood vessels that lie there. So you could imagine that this creates a challenge at times when it comes at time to resect tumors on the pancreas. So a tumor can be poorly located on the pancreas and makes surgical resection quite challenging. So this is a close-up view of the pancreas. Here's the fish again, tail of the fish and head of the fish. Here's the mouth of the fish. At the mouth of the mouth of the fish empties into the duodenum, which is the first part of the intestine. And what it empties into the duodenum are pancreatic enzymes, what we need to digest food. And these pancreatic enzymes are made by these cells here called acinar cells. Ductal cells that line the pancreatic duct make mucus as well as a base to help with these enzymes, with the function of these enzymes. These other clusters of cells are called islet cells. These cells are responsible for making hormones like insulin, and they're responsible for the endocrine part of pancreatic function, whereas this is responsible for the exocrine part of pancreatic function. There are two types of cells in the pancreas, and therefore there are two types of cancers in the pancreas. One of them is adenocarcinoma of the pancreas that arises from these ductal cells and from these acinar cells, and the other one is neuroendocrine tumors that arise from these islet cells. The focus of tonight's talk, and when people talk about pancreas cancer, for the most part, they're describing this sort of cancer. Steve Jobs, Patrick Swayze. Symptoms. Unfortunately, the symptoms, there's no pain. Pain does not happen at an early start of pancreas cancer. Pain occurs late in the disease and is often a late symptom. Patients present with back pain, usually represents locally advanced disease and at times metastatic disease. Weight loss occurs early on, fairly early on. Sometimes there's new onset of diabetes. Patients have a poor control, have a new diagnosis of diabetes with poor control of their sugar. But most of the time, a patient presents in our emergency department with what's called painless, no pain, and yellow jaundice, yellow eyes, where at times their whole skin is yellow, they may have pale stools, or they may have a change in their urine color. So that's how patients present. And this diagnosis, as Michelle said, is often difficult to make. Sometimes the new onset of diabetes is what we focus on initially, or when patients present to the community doctors, that's what they focus on. And there's a weight loss that happens, and people really attribute the weight loss to the diabetes. And sometimes there's a bit of a delay in making the diagnosis, in a couple of weeks or even a month's delay, hopefully not longer. But I'll show you later on in the talk that pancreas cancer takes over a decade to develop. These statistics are not very good, but what I'd like to say is that they hopefully represent pancreas cancer of the past, and pancreas cancer of the future statistics will be a lot better. This is a survival curve. This is when 100% of patients survive. This is at the start of diagnosis at 0 years, and as you can see, as we approach 10 years following diagnosis, it does not look very good. But a lot of this is historical data prior to advances, not only in the operating room, but also in chemotherapy. In Canada, there will be 4,000 new cases of pancreas cancer diagnosed in 2011. Of those, the majority will go on and succumb to their disease. So the incidence case of pancreas cancer approximates the deaths due to pancreas cancer each year. The deaths due to pancreas cancer each year. The mortality of this disease is high. It is the highest mortality of all major cancers. 5-year survival of all comers, those that have both resectable cancers that we could take out and cancers that have metastasized at the time of diagnosis, if we take all patients, the survival is only 6% at 5 years. Again, these are the statistics, and I felt obliged to put them up, but at the same time, I'm hoping they're historical values and we could change the future. If we take 100 patients that Peter and I will see in the clinic this year, we will see approximately 200 at McGill, and the other 800 patients are spread across the other three centers in the province. of these 100 patients, about 20 of them will look at the scans and will say, sure, we will pre-op them and take them to the operating room. We could take out their tumor, and we're going to achieve this sort of survival in 5 years, mostly due to the lack of good chemotherapy. We think we could change this by tailoring their chemotherapy. Unfortunately, most of the patients will present either with metastatic disease or locally advanced disease that's not amenable to surgical resection. But there's been changes in chemotherapy, and I think we're starting to shift some of these patients into this category, and I'll show you an example. In fact, we have an example in the room tonight. This is pancreas cancer. This is where it happens many of the times. It happens at the head of the pancreas. It's ugly. This is what it looks like. To take it out, well, this is what Peter does. I take more of the stomach out. And we take out the good portion of the bile duct, the gallbladder, stomach, or just the duodenum, the pancreas, good third of the pancreas, the first part of the small intestine right up to here. And then we have to hook it all back up. That's what it looks like at the end. This hookup here, where we hook up the pancreas to the intestine, took many, many years to optimize. And it's probably one of the most difficult connections that we do in general surgery. This is what a CAT scan looks at, and this is what we stare in the clinic at when we make a decision as to whether we could offer you surgery up front. This is where the cancer lies. And these here are two very important blood vessels. This one here is called the superior mesenteric vein or portal vein. In the old days, not too long ago, when I was a trainee, if this was involved with tumor, we would not proceed. We would say it's locally advanced, and the patient would be considered palliative. We've learned, and I'll show you the data, that we could cut this tumor out with a portion of this vein and reconstruct it using our transplant hats, using our ability to sew vessels together. And patients do just as well over 5 years. This artery here cannot be involved. If it's involved, it often represents disease that's escaped, it's become centralized, and it's probably lying somewhere else, like in the liver. We just can't see it yet. What we want to exclude also is that there's no distant disease. There's no metastases in the liver. There's no metastases in the lining. So that's what we look at. If we exclude distant disease and we think locally it's resectable from a technical and safety point of view, but also that it makes oncologic sense to take it out, that it's not involving this artery. And if it is involving this artery, there are certain circumstances where we will take it out, but we have to make sure it makes some oncologic sense and we're not leaving the patient with cancer intentionally behind. You could also have a tumor at the tail of the pancreas, the body of the pancreas, this part of the pancreas. This operation carries less risk. We could even do it at times with a camera. But in the case of pancreas cancer, we will most often we will do it with an open surgery, and we will take the spleen most of the time. I should say that we don't see many of these tumors because the patients do not develop symptoms up until it's quite late and the tumor has locally advanced and has invaded in the back where the spine is. And those are the patients that quite often present with back pain. So this is the real advance we've made in pancreas cancer management. We've made a lot of surgical advances. This fellow called Whipple in 1935 did this operation that we do today in half a day or less, in 2 days. He observed. He then went on to be able to do it in 1 day and observed a mortality rate of 31%, and this carried on until the early 90s, where we were able to drop our mortality rate down to between 0 and 2%, comparable to what the risk rates are with open heart surgery. And how did we achieve this? We learned that we have to have centers of excellence. MUHC is a center of excellence for hepatobiliary surgical oncology. St. Luke's Hospital is. Princess Margaret, Toronto General Hospital are, as is Sunnybrook. Those are the centers that have surgeons that do ample of these operations per year. They're the centers that have interventional radiologists that have learned to manage complications. and they have health staff, nursing staff, and a whole team of folks that are able to deal not only with the surgery, but also with the care of these patients. And when there is a complication, they're able to intervene effectively. So the take-home message for those of you that may be contemplating where to have surgery would be in a center that doesn't just have an experienced surgeon, but has a team, a medical team that consists of more than a surgeon that will deliver the care that you need. Is more surgery better? The answer is no. So we've asked the question, if we start taking out all of these lymph nodes, so cells can spread into, cancer cells can spread in two ways. They could spread through the blood or they could spread through the lymphatic system. And I apologize if I'm oversimplifying for some folks, but I wouldn't be for my mom. And the lymphatic system essentially drains fluid from tissues. And cancer cells enter that fluid and they spread throughout the body. And one idea was, well, what if we take that lymphatic system, these lymph nodes out, maybe we will capture those cells that have escaped and we will cure the patients. Well, they've done this. And they've gone up and they've resected, they've taken all of these this lymphatic tissue and these lymph nodes right up into the aorta, all the way down here and across this way, and subjected patients to that increased in a trial, in the way it should be done, into an increased risk of surgery. And we learned that their outcomes were equivalent. They were no better. So more surgery for the time being is not better with respect to lymph nodes. What about these two vessels here? The pancreas is the fish. It lies here. And then there is this artery. This is that big artery called the aorta. Brings blood from the heart across throughout our body. There are two vessels. This is what's called the celiac trunk, and this is the superior mesenteric artery. We need them. One of them supplies the liver. The other one supplies the rest of your small bowel. We can't cut them out, and we can't put them back together, but it has to make oncologic sense. If a tumor is sitting right here, and we can't make that tumor shrink, chances are there are cancer cells that have escaped both that way and that way. It does not make a lot of oncologic sense to do that, to resect this piece of artery. Over here, if there's tumor here, because it's away from a more central place in a fit patient that has a good response to chemotherapy or at least shows no progression to chemotherapy, Peter and I will take that patient to the operating room, likely together, as with these cases, two surgeons is probably the way to go. The portal vein, well, I told you that the data tells us that you could cut a piece of portal vein out and the outcomes are the same as long as it's technically feasible to reconstruct it. And those are where tumors can lie. So the artery. The reason the artery is a problem is because there's this train track. I call it a train track. And it's a tissue of nerves and lymphatic tissue that lies in the pancreas, behind the pancreas. And this train track goes all the way to this artery, the aorta. And what it does is it provides a route for cancer cells to spread. And what we'd like to do is take all of this train track out. But if we find that the tumor, we could actually see tumor over here, we're usually quite worried that the disease has spread, and therefore we don't give up, but we suggest chemotherapy for the patients. This just highlights the studies that show that the outcomes with a portal vein resection are equivalent to without a portal vein resection. And I'm highlighting this because there are centers that contemplate doing portal vein resections, and I think the data does not support that. The data supports that if it's technically or safely feasible, then the patient should be offered that surgery. These are the data from arterial resections. Dr. Fortner is a surgeon at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, was a surgeon when I was, I think, in diapers still. And he early on asked the question, could we take out arteries in pancreas cancer? And he learned that there are no 5-year survivors. We have done it in Toronto in select cases. We haven't seen our data yet for 5 years. But we're uncertain what those data will show. What we are doing different both in Toronto and at McGill, when we are considering these patients now, we're considering them on protocol. That means we have a specific protocol to treat them, and we're following them, and we're learning what their outcomes are. And we're also doing it in the context of giving them chemotherapy beforehand, whereas in the older studies, they did not receive any chemotherapy beforehand. And I think that makes a difference. And that's a paradigm shift in the management of pancreas cancer. So, yeah, we can't take out arteries. Here's a vein that we took. Here's a vein that's involved in this patient. I did this as a fellow in Toronto. And this vein was involved. Here's an artery that's involved. And there's a big chunk of artery that's involved with tumor. But this sort of portion here was not involved. The tumor started not right on what's called the aorta, right in the center. It started fairly further down. And the patient got chemotherapy, and there was no progression of disease. In fact, we noticed some shrinkage of the tumor. So we took the patient to the operating room. We cut out this portion of the portal vein. We couldn't bring the two ends together. But, you know, there are other ways of sorting it out. We took a piece of the patient's left kidney vein, and we used it as a tube in between and hooked it back up, and the left kidney survives just fine. There's other ways for it to drain. And then we took a piece of a leg vein and cut out this tumor and sewed the artery back. So it is possible in the right patient. So we can't win with surgery alone. We need to have good chemotherapy. And we know this because if we operate on patients and do not give them chemotherapy, 80% of them will have disease recurrence within 12 months. They'll either have disease recurrence where we took it out, or they'll have distant metastases within 12 months. And we know that surgery alone gives a median, so the average survival is only 12 months. And we could certainly improve on that. And we learn that by doing trials. So the word adjuvant in cancer means giving chemotherapy after surgery. The word neoadjuvant in cancer means giving chemotherapy before surgery. So these are the trials that looked at giving chemotherapy after surgery. These are the key trials. And they were difficult to undertake because most patients did not do well. They had complications. Many of them could not complete chemotherapy. So it took a very long time to get a proper trial completed to give us an answer. And the important trial is this one here, which showed us that this new drug called gemcitabine, at the time was a new drug, compared to surgery alone, patients did better. There's another drug called 5-FU, which was initially used in the early days for colon cancer, and its performance is equivalent to gemcitabine, in terms of patient outcome, but it's less tolerated. So the standard of care is for patients to receive gemcitabine after surgery. So then many had the thought, well, why don't we combine gemcitabine with with different types of drugs, like cisplatin? And I've highlighted cisplatin because we'll come back to it, because in all comers, if you take all patients and give them gemcitabine and cisplatin, there's no difference than just giving gemcitabine alone. At least that's what our trials have shown us to date. So most of these combination drugs, if we take all patients and do not tailor chemotherapy, just give it to everyone, there's not going to be a difference. You might as well just give gemcitabine alone. So what are our most current outcomes? So in the early days, I think we were looking at survival rates at 5 years of about 10, maybe 15%. And with the addition of chemotherapy, and in some centers like MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, they give chemotherapy to all patients before resecting the tumor, we could achieve 5-year survival rates. And again, this is a bit historical data because it's reporting from 5-plus years back of about 30%, 27 to 30%. Not great, but we are slowly making progress. And I think as we start tailoring their treatment, we'll make even more progress. As mentioned, one of the problems is that we get recurrence. And the recurrence happens where we cut where we cut the pancreas and the area that we leave behind. We're trying to improve our surgical techniques by taking most of this tissue out. But that is probably not going to be the answer on its own. And we think the answer there lies to giving chemotherapy. And here's an example of how this is a tumor. This is sent to me by Matthew Katz. Matt is a surgical oncologist in Houston. And when Matthew went to the operating room, he looked at this on the CT scan. Here's the border on the CT scan of the tumor. Here's the artery. And he had this black plane. This black plane means it's tumor-free. But when he did this operation and took all of this tissue outlined by this red line, then he sent it to pathology, and pathology report comes back, and Matt observed that he only had a 1 millimeter margin. So he was only 1 millimeter away from the tumor site, which is very, very close. In this other case, he didn't have a 1 millimeter margin. In fact, he was right on the edge of the tumor. So this is to highlight that in some cases, giving chemotherapy, and perhaps in all cases, maybe there needs to be a paradigm shift. And as opposed to going straight to the operating room, maybe what we need to be doing is giving patients chemotherapy first, seeing what their response is, and perhaps this will improve our outcomes. We've seen this. This is not a novel approach. We've seen this in rectal cancer. In the old days, you used to go to the operating room. You were diagnosed with rectal cancer. We would go to the operating room, and we'd have a resection, and then we would get chemotherapy and radiation. We've learned now that we improve our outcomes by giving patients radiation and chemotherapy before going to the operating room. And what we're challenging is maybe this is what we should be doing with pancreas cancer. But it's very hard to convince a patient with a 1 centimeter tumor that they should wait and get chemotherapy first when we're not sure whether this chemotherapy works. So likely what we will be doing, and these are the discussions Peter and I are having with our group, is offering chemotherapy to patients that do not have resectable disease right up front, that have borderline resectable disease. So disease that may come out, but we're uncertain about the margins, giving those patients chemotherapy first and then going on to resect them, and perhaps continuing with the dogma of surgery first in patients that have very small tumors. This is the newest drug on the market. It's called FOLFIRINOX. It's a combination drug. It was tried against gemcitabine, the gold standard in all clinical trials. We always compare it to the gold standard. We start clinical trials with a new cocktail or a new drug by looking at patients with metastatic disease, patients that unfortunately are not curable. The patients are randomized to two arms, one arm that receives FOLFIRINOX and the other one that gets gemcitabine, and we see the outcomes. And this was striking. The survival, although not great, it doubled pretty much, or close to doubled. It went from close to 7 months to 11 plus months with this new drug. So in patients that are able to tolerate this new drug combination with metastatic pancreas cancer, those are the patients that will receive. Those patients will go on to have this. At McGill, we've developed a study where we're using this drug in patients that do not have or have borderline resectable disease. So patients that we're not sure we could resect, we give them this drug, we study it on trial, and we hope to make we're still giving the drug to them with a curative intent. A couple of more minutes at a closer look at this devastating disease. So we had a clinical overview. What about what causes this disease? There have been numerous associations. Smoking is the only epidemiological study association that keeps on holding. Western society, our society, is a risk factor. Most studies highlight smoking as the consistent epidemiological factor. So closer to 10%, I would say, of pancreas cancer is hereditary. That means it's transmitted from generation to generation. And there are two lines of evidence that we have to support this hypothesis or this notion. One comes from clustering of pancreas cancer. So if we look at families, we find that there are clusters of pancreas cancers in family trees. This is of interest in Quebec. One of the earliest studies done on looking at familial clustering of pancreas cancer was done here in Montreal. And the scientists at the time found that there's a higher incidence of pancreas cancer in patients that were diagnosed with pancreas cancer in their families than in patients from the general population. So there's, and it has been reported that there may be what's called the founder mutation. There may be a mutation in the French-Canadian population that is unique to the French-Canadian population and responsible for inherited pancreas cancer. The second line of evidence comes from known hereditary syndromes, so syndromes where there's a genetic mutation that's passed on from generation to generation, in which pancreas cancer is one of the tumor types that's associated with this, with these hereditary syndromes. So what's the risk of most of us developing pancreas cancer over a lifetime, and over a lifetime is by the age of 70, up to 0.5%. If you carry a BRCA mutation, a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, the risk is around 5%. If you carry a mutation that gives rise to something called familial pancreatitis, it's up to 40%. In those cases where there's clustering of pancreas cancer in the family, and we define familial pancreas cancer as having two or more first-degree relatives affected with pancreas cancer. And first-degree relatives are those, are brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, and children. The risk is up to 30%. So, as mentioned, you know, there's a genetic change. Our cells have what's called the nucleus. There's something called chromosomes. We carry 13 of them. These are big. There's a lot of there's a lot of this DNA bit, which if we unwind will come down to a gene. And genes are really chemical letters, and these chemical letters are our body's library, and we use these chemical letters to tell ourselves what to do. And if we have mistakes in these chemical letters, they're called mutations, and if they occur in all cell types of our body, then they're inherited and they can give rise to familial cancers. If they happen at random in just the pancreas or in one cell type, they're called somatic mutations or changes. They're not inherited and they're not responsible for pancreas cancer, and they probably represent 90% of the pancreas cancer causes. This is a family of pancreas cancer. This is what a family looks like. Each vertical line represents a generation, and circles represent females, squares represent males. A white box represents affected by cancer, and a line, unfortunately, represents death. And you could see that this patient here had two first-degree relatives on her mother's, on his mother's side affected with pancreas cancer, and the gene for this disease, for this syndrome, is unknown. There have been several studies. One gene has been pinpointed as the cause of familial pancreas cancer called Paladin. It's likely what's called a private mutation. It probably occurs just in this one family. When we went sought out to see if this mutation occurs in more families that have familial pancreas cancer, we did not identify it. So it's likely the cause of a pancreas cancer in a small group of families. This just simply shows the risk of developing pancreas cancer if you carry mutations in one of these genes. And finally, this is what it takes. These are the number of years it takes to get from the start of a mutation that gives rise to a bad cell to the potential of a clone, a group of cells, to be able to metastasize. So to get from the start of this bad mutation or this change, this genetic change, to the point where a cell has the potential or a group of cells have the potential to metastasize is over 10 years. So pancreas cancer does not happen yesterday. It takes a very long time for it to develop. And maybe we could use that to our advantage to screen patients and identify pancreas cancer early on. So in order to do that, we need things like a patient registry, and that's something we'd like to do here in Quebec. And we could use it to screen both patients and their families. We could use it for research like Dr. Tremblay was describing, and also to individualize patient chemotherapy. How do I go back, Michelle?
Thank you.
anyway, the bottom line with respect to screening programs, they have failed. And this is the largest one that we did with Steve Gallinger in Toronto, screened 259 patients over a decade with a mean follow-up period of 3.5 years. And we failed to identify cases early on. The two cases we identified, unfortunately, had metastatic disease at the time. The reason for that is probably we don't have the right imaging modality yet, and we need to work out what imaging modality to use. In the consensus is that if a patient has more than a 5% risk of pancreas cancer over a lifetime, they likely should be screened. And one of the programs we'll be starting here at McGill is a screening program with Peter and Will Folks, as well as Dr. Peter Kavan. Individualized, I just gave away the punchline, but individualized chemotherapy is where we're going. We need to tailor chemotherapy. There's one-size-fits-all chemotherapy is historical. It's sort of responsible for those terrible curves, and we will change that. And genetics and understanding genetics will help us do that. Libby is the first patient that I saw benefit from individualized chemotherapy, and that is why I wanted Libby to be here tonight. I think she has a remarkable story to share, and it's probably the first patient that I know of in Canada that benefited from tailored chemotherapy. The timing was right. Libby will share her story with you, but essentially Libby is a survivor of both breast and pancreatic cancer. We knew at the time that she had a BRCA mutation. And we also knew from ovarian cancer work that the patients with BRCA mutations in their cells respond to this drug, cisplatin. And without going through the science, we were fairly convinced of this, and we decided to treat her with cisplatin and the standard gemcitabine and give her some radiation as well. And we took an unresectable tumor resectable tumor. And I was not there because, unfortunately, I was committed to a different hospital at the time, but her surgeon called me at the end of the night, and he says that was the most amazing operation I've ever done. And it was special. I mean, I think it was one of the first times that we were able to take an incurable patient to a cure. Since then, we've had success. We've treated a total of 7 patients. Memorial Sloan Kettering has treated a total of 14 patients using similar approaches. And we're learning that patients with the mutations in the BRCA gene have a different disease. And even if they have locally advanced or bad disease, we may be able to intervene and even provide a hope for cure. This is a patient presented with something that we could not resect, but also a patient that had metastases. We gave the same sort of treatment. The metastases went away. The tumor shrunk. We hum and hawed. And eventually, after I left Toronto, Steve Gallinger resected this tumor and took this little piece of liver out. Was not able to find a tumor because it had gone away. It had responded. But nonetheless, took it out. We'll see what happens. But we're optimistic. We would not have gone to the operating room if we did not have a hope for cure. And the BRCA story is very special to Montreal and Quebec. We know from work done by William Folks, a prominent geneticist here, cancer geneticist here at McGill, that in the Quebec population, these mutations occur at a rate of 6 to 10%. And in some other communities, like an Ashkenazi Jewish community, these mutations occur at a rate of about 10%. In the general population, the rest of Canada, these mutations occur at about a rate of 0.5%. So one of the programs we're starting in my laboratory with Peter as well is to screen all new diagnoses of pancreas cancer for this panel of 14, and Will tells me we could take it up to 21 mutations. So every patient with a diagnosis of pancreas cancer, we will put them through a research platform and screen them for these mutations. And we're hoping to alter their care at the same time. So we'll put it through a research platform, identify, confirm through a clinical lab with William Folks, and then intervene with Dr. Peter Kavan and change their chemotherapy and hopefully change their outcome and improve their outcome. So that's where we're heading. Cancer is a disease of the genome, their genetic changes. When I started back here at McGill in the early 90s, I used this sort of gizmo, and if I was able to sequence 300 bases a day, I was pretty happy. Tom Hudson arrived and we were doing a million bases. They were doing a million bases in the early 2000s. In 2011, we could do a billion bases. We could sequence the whole genome. Cost is dropping. It's getting down to about 5,000. So we're doing this in an international effort. Tom Hudson is heading it for pancreas cancer in Toronto. We will contribute. And finally, going back to this idea of tailored chemotherapy, here's a tumor. Standard chemotherapy kills most of the cells, but I'm not sure it actually kills these cells called cancer stem cells, which are probably responsible for metastasizing and initiating tumor growth. So you kill them, you leave three cells, you don't see the tumor, but the tumor comes back because the ones that are responsible to start tumor growth are left behind. If you streamline it and kill these cells, eventually the tumor will shrink, and what's left behind we could resect. That's the end of my talk, and this is the study that we're starting. It's called the Quebec Pancreas Study, and the only French I'm able to say tonight is Études Québécoises du cancer du pancréas. It's a study where we'll enroll all patients with a diagnosis of pancreas cancer, initially at McGill, then in Montreal. We'll expand to Montreal and hopefully across Quebec. This will be our website. It's up and running now. We're just getting the institutional approvals in place. These are the folks to thank. I won't go through them, but this is the most important slide. Our patients, we owe it to them. This is Lindsay. Lindsay is a special person. She was a patient I met in Toronto. She was in her early 20s when I met her, and she was a law student at the same time. She went to law school on gemcitabine and other more toxic chemotherapy. She passed away in the month of November, Pancreas Cancer Month, and this is a poem that she wrote. With that, I'll give the mic back to, I would like to introduce another special pancreas cancer survivor, Libby Zimon, and she doesn't take much of an introduction. I think Michelle has already introduced her. She's absolutely amazing and has done very good work for pancreas cancer as a whole. Not only in Canada, but also abroad. Thank you.
Ça va? Hello, hello, hello.
You're very okay.
Okay. OK. OK, je vais commencer en français. Ça me fait grand plaisir d'être ici à Montréal. C'est la ville où je suis née et où j'ai grandi pendant mon enfance. Je suis une Canadienne de première génération car mes parents étaient des réfugiés après la Seconde Guerre mondiale. Je suis née à l'hôpital général juif et pendant ce temps, nous vivions sur le célèbre rue Saint-Urbain. Comme vous le savez, j'ai eu le cancer deux fois. En première, il y a 5 ans, j'ai été diagnostiquée avec un cancer du sein et 2 ans plus tard avec un cancer de pancréas. OK. OK. Ça va? Non? Ça va? OK. OK. So, en première, il y a 5 ans, j'ai été diagnostiquée avec un cancer du sein et 2 ans plus tard, j'ai été diagnostiquée avec un cancer de pancréas. Ce genre de cancer est le plus mortel. On a entendu de ça. Mais j'ai eu le bonheur d'être entre les mains des docteurs qui sont très, très compétents. Et je suis très chanceuse d'être ici avec vous ce soir. Alors, eh bien, maintenant, je vais continuer mon discours en anglais. So, 3 years ago tonight, I was at home recovering from my Whipple operation that George just told you about. Mine lasted 6.5 hours. It wasn't that long. They took a quarter of my pancreas, half my stomach, a whole pile of small bowel, and they reconnected it that way. That looks a lot scarier than I even thought. It was not a very easy recovery, but I was very, very lucky to be in that position because, as George told you, only 15 to 20% of patients are lucky enough to be eligible for that surgery. And if you can imagine such a thing, the reason that I got lucky was that because I had already had breast cancer. And the doctors knew enough from my bout of breast cancer to be able to give me the individualized treatment that ultimately saved my life. So let me go back to the beginning of the story, which is my late mother. I really wasn't very surprised when I was diagnosed with breast cancer 5 years ago. My mother had it when she was only 42, and I was a very, very small child, and I grew up looking at the horribly disfiguring scars from her radical mastectomy. And through the years, she suffered with really, really bad lymphedema. She had a hugely swollen left arm, and if she got the tiniest scratch or burn, it just never, never healed. But difficult as it was, that treatment allowed her to survive for 30 years and to thrive for 30 years. And so even though I understood that I was at high risk for breast cancer, I never really worried that it was going to kill me. My mother eventually died of ovarian cancer, and she died a very, very painful death because the disease wasn't diagnosed until it was much too late. And that was at the end of 1993, and that was just about a little more than a year before the discovery of the BRCA genes, or rather the mutation in the BRCA genes that usually protect you against breast and ovarian cancer and other cancers as well. So having those mutations doesn't just mean that you're at a higher risk for getting a cancer, you're also at significantly higher risk of getting a second cancer. Not a recurrence, not a metastasis, but a second completely other cancer. I hope there's no thirds. So I can't say I was on top of things when the discovery of the gene was made. First of all, I never ever twigged onto the breast-ovarian connection, even though it was very widely reported. And basically I thought I was completely covered just by having an annual mammogram. And it wasn't until I was actually diagnosed with breast cancer that the genetic connection started to twig. And I remember that I was at a very boozy dinner just as I was in the process of being diagnosed. And I was very lucky that a former neighbor of mine was visiting. She had left, and she was the head of breast radiology at one of the Mayo clinics in Wisconsin. And after she had a bunch of drinks, she started poking her finger at me and said, "Sweetheart, you have bad genes, and if I were you, I would have both my breasts and my ovaries removed as quickly as possible all at once." Okay. So it was certainly something to think about, but very difficult under the pressure of a cancer diagnosis. It turns out that my own doctors were making that connection at the same time, and actually the very next morning I got a call from the Center for Familial and Hereditary Breast Cancer, which is run by Dr. Stephen Nayrod, who is one of the discoverers of BRCA and one of the leading BRCA researchers in the world. And they literally, they were about to go on holiday. It was the summer. And it was amazing because I was on the phone with them. I know very, very little about my family history because both sides of my family were basically killed in the Second World War. So they asked me a few questions that I didn't have the answer to. It's like, blah, 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 you have a 60% chance of whatever. Get in here right away. We're going on holiday. And they said they were going to give me a rush genetic test. Now, not everybody can get a rush genetic test because, as George explained, in the general population, the mutations can occur in any one of 27,000 nucleotides, so they all have to be checked. However, if you're an Ashkenazi Jew, they only occur in one of three places. So the test is a lot cheaper, and it can be done in a matter of days. And I remember when they explained this to me, it kind of reminded me of those old Borscht Belt jokes, you know, where the punchline is, choose somebody else. So even with the rush order, I wasn't going to get the result until a day before my surgery was scheduled. And I spent a lot of time angsting about what would I want to do if it turned out to be positive? Would I want to have that preventive bilateral mastectomy? And I was sort of really thinking about it a lot until the doctor gently explained to me that nobody was going to keep a surgeon in an operating room on hold so I could decide at the last minute. So much for that. I was actually much more worried about the ovarian cancer than I was about the breast cancer, so much so that I even asked the doctor if I could have my ovaries out first. She said no. But I decided I was going to do that as quickly as possible. So I remember it was kind of those early days, and I literally didn't know which deadly cancer to worry about first. And some strange things started to happen the way I sort of perceived the whole thing. One of the things was it was really, really odd. I started to think of myself in the third person, and I had a name for myself. It was Cancer Girl, which was very, very strange. And I realized that it was because I really couldn't reconcile the word cancer and the word me, because I thought of myself as a healthy person. And I also started to feel like I was entering a completely different country, cancer land. And that is actually a very common perception with cancer patients. It's like a whole other universe. And I remember I started feeling that as soon as I got a call, the call that, you know, your lump is suspicious. By the way, it was missed on a mammogram, but that's a whole other story. So I remember going out to tell my husband about this, and it sort of looked like everything had shifted. And one of the things that happens when you enter cancer land is that there is a whole lot of very, very complicated information that you have to take in. And generally speaking, especially if you have an early cancer and there are choices, you have to turn around and use that information to make life-saving or not, to make very, very difficult medical decisions about your care. And I remember at first I would literally, I sort of went through an informal network when I was first diagnosed. You know, I knew people, there were some doctors that I knew socially. There were one of the other media, the media doctor in town, she'd had breast cancer as well. So, you know, one person would send me to another. And I remember I would just come home completely exhausted because I felt like I was really, really hit by this barrage of information. And just, you know, as an aside, I'm used to having to process a lot of information quickly. I'm a journalist. I'm used to getting, you know, a mound of documents and having to go away for an hour and turn around and get up in front of a camera and sound like I know what I'm talking about. But I know that I don't always actually know what I'm talking about when I do that. So I remember feeling very strongly that I really wasn't equipped to make these decisions. And for me, the toughest thing about the breast cancer was making that decision about whether to have this preventive, very, very radical surgery. Just by the way, about 25% of women who find they have these mutations go for it. But usually it's after a lot of soul searching and before they have cancer. And having those choices is really one of the things that changed since my mother was sick, because in her day, you went to the doctor, he told you what to do, and you did it. And by the time I was treated for breast cancer, most of the doctors were she's, and they were a lot more mindful of what I thought, in my opinion, actually a little too mindful. So I remember that it was, you know, hard to take it all in. I remember I even realized that I couldn't take proper notes, and I asked my husband to take the notes for me. He's been an editor of major papers. He's written 3 books. As I said earlier, he's never shy about telling me that he's much more accurate, organized, and better at doing this. So I asked him to take the notes, and a few weeks into it, I asked to see the notes. And it was literally, it was a couple of doodles and a few incomprehensible lines. So I think it's very, very difficult for patients, especially if you have no scientific background, to take all this in and to take all this in at a time when it is really, really traumatic. So at first they weren't sure if I had one lump with some satellites or 3 separate lumps, which means they weren't sure if I should have a lumpectomy or a mastectomy to begin with. And I remember I was having a lot of tests, and I was really overwhelmed with gratitude one day. I was having yet another ultrasound. The radiologist walked into the room and she picked up the wand herself and she started doing the test. And I said, oh, you're here to figure out what kind of surgery I need. And she said to me, well, you know, it doesn't just matter what we say. It depends what you want. And I didn't say anything to her, but what I was thinking was, I want to live to be old. And again, it was, I felt this was a bit of a burden. And so one of the things I started to do, I thought, okay, all these doctors are women. I'm going to ask them what they would do if it were them. And I quickly found out that to a woman, they had seen all the worst cases. They were all these really uber type A personalities who needed to feel like they were in control. And they would have all done what my friend Anne Marie originally suggested, like have everything removed, as radical as possible. And I had to realize that wasn't necessarily the right answer for me. Anyway, once I opted not to have the preventative double mastectomy, I started to feel like I could put the whole thing behind me. I had chemo, I had radiation, and then I made the best and the easiest decision that resulted from my cancer. I became a redhead. And, you know, once again, I thought I was covered. You know, people talk about a new normal after cancer and how hard it is to get adjusted. And for me, the only thing was that I had a really, really rigorous schedule of doctor's appointments and tests. And you would not believe the things that they screened me for. I had tests for peritoneal cancer, which apparently I could still get even though I had my ovaries removed. Every 6 months, I've tried to push it to a year. I go see a skin doctor who puts on this thing that looks like a mining light, and he basically goes over every inch of me, even though I don't have any moles. You know, I love that. Apparently, there's a higher risk of melanoma. But nobody told me to screen for the most lethal cancer that there is. As a matter of fact, no one mentioned it at all. So, not that there's a good method to screen. That's a whole other issue. When I started to feel sick in 2008, in the spring of 2008, it took quite a while. I thought I had an ulcer. I thought I had acid reflux. I went through with my GP and we ruled a whole pile of things out. It took quite a bit of time. I started to feel sick in April and didn't get a diagnosis till July. So we ruled things out, and I actually had an appointment set for September with a specialist for a colonoscopy, and I asked my doctor, I said, you know, can you get it moved up? And he could not get it moved up. I tried to get it moved up. Could not. I mean, basically what they said to me was, lady, if you don't like it, go to eMERGE, which is what I did. And yeah, so in eMERGE, they found it right away. And it took me 2 days in there to see the resident, the GI resident. And he had a look at the scans, and he told me, he said, don't worry, your cancer is operable, and I've got you in with the best surgeon. And he told me that he was going to do it. When I got to the surgeon's office, it was a little different. It was, I don't like this scan. We're giving you another scan right away. And he also started telling me that given my genetic status, I should have been screened, and I should have known that. And, of course, nobody had ever mentioned that to me. Now, one of the good bits of news that results from this is that a couple of the breast oncologists that I know have told me that since my case has happened, they've started to screen BRCA people for pancreas cancer. But anyway, one thing that the surgeon did not say to me was that this was a death sentence, and that's exactly what I had been told in emergency just a few days before. And I wasn't diagnosed early. It was what George was describing as a locally advanced tumor. It was wrapped around, I'm not sure what it was wrapped around. He probably knows more than me. I don't know if it was veins in the artery or just veins. Both, yeah. Okay, that's what I thought. And the doctors suggested that we try chemo to shrink the tumor. One thing that I'm really, really glad that they didn't give me too much information, because they did not bother to add that basically that never works. And they went through quite a process to try to figure out what chemo to give me. The timing was very good because there had just been some research published about a new class of drugs that target the mutation, a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors, which, of course, were experimental and not available. But they all consulted together, and they decided to give me the cisplatin along with the gemcitabine. I have never been as sick as I was on the first cycle of cisplatin. It was just horrible. I guess that means it was working. And I had two cycles of it, and I had a scan. And much to everybody's big surprise, it had worked, because the tumor had moved off of my veins in the artery. It had gone down a full stage. It was stage 3 when it was diagnosed, and it went down to being stage 2. So I had the surgery, and I remember beforehand the surgeon told me that he expected to find cancer in the lymph nodes, but he did not. So for me, it was a tough recovery, but I've been cancer-free since that operation 3 years ago, almost exactly. And unlike my mother's cancer treatment, the main side effect is very pleasant. I now eat whatever I want without gaining weight. There's a postscript, as you heard from George. I may have been the first case, but I'm not the last. Other people have had success with the same treatment for the same disease. My doctors also are planning to test all their patients for BRCA mutations. They're setting up a tumor bank. They already have it partially done in Toronto. I gave it the office. And they're working very, very hard to discover other mutations that cause this terrible disease. We've made some progress in Ontario, and as you've heard from the doctors here, that's what they want to do here. They want to duplicate some of that here in Quebec, and I think you should help them go for it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Libby. So we have about 15 minutes to ask questions. I'd like to George to join us too. So we will have already one question. We don't have the little stickers tonight. So people, you're doing a great example to stand up like this. I thank you very much. So just tell who you want the answer. But you have to do it pretty loud, and I'm going to give that, and relatively short, if you don't mind, because I'm sure we have many people that it has to come, and if everybody has a nice story, you have to come here, because it's not going to go. But it's worth, you look like convincing, so I think we will give him a chance to answer that.
Yeah, it's for the benefit of everybody. The short answer is, it was without vascular involvement, apparently, resection was a possibility mentioned, as well as chemotherapy. We did not hear anything about radiation therapy to speak of. Now, I had the good fortune to spend some time in the States, and a friend of mine is vice chair of medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and his older brother is an oncologist at UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. The short story is we flew our mother down to UPMC, and Herbert Zay down there, whose name may be familiar to you, and they brought to my mother's attention another option, which I haven't heard here, but I'm sure these doctors are aware of. It's a concentrated form of radiation therapy called radiosurgery. UPMC uses CyberKnife, but adapted by software known as Trilogy, which was developed out of Stanford. And what it is, it's a very concentrated and one-time, highly concentrated dosage of radiation. Now, the story is obviously in process. So she underwent this therapy, this radiation treatment, first week of June. First week of September, back down to UPMC. The CAT scan showed a melting or necrophying tumor, and her blood work was clear. She's going to have another CAT scan and blood work in December. My question is simply this. Why did we have to go down to UPMC to hear about this therapy?
Well, that was a long prelude, but we got it. So thank you very much. I think I'll give that to George.
The short answer is it's unproven methodology, technology. One, two is it is available in Canada. In fact, it's funded by someone that's in the audience here at a research on a research basis in Ottawa, and it is available in Montreal as well. The circumstances by. I mean, I do not know your mother's case fully to be able to comment whether it was applicable there or not. But it is available predominantly on a research basis. It's not the standard of care. The short answer is that it's folks reporting their own experience. There were not study protocols that were put in place beforehand. We're only now putting study protocols in place. So it's really, it's variable, it's chart review data. It is not to scale, and it's... It depends on the circumstance. So each patient we will consider.
I can't say enough about the benefits of exercising when you're recovering from cancer. I got back to exercise as fast as I could. I was back on the tennis court a little more than 2 months after the Whipple, and it wasn't a lot of fun at first, but I really think that the exercise really helped me recover quickly. When I had breast cancer, I basically, aside from recovering from surgery, didn't miss a beat. I used to have a game the morning after chemotherapy. There have now been studies in breast cancer which show how much exercise helps recovery. In some cases, it also has been shown to prevent it. So I think basically the fact that I'm fit, it was hard to learn to eat again. Now that I can, I eat whatever I want to. So that's the answer to that.
Thank you.
There is no modality. We haven't worked out a protocol for it in Quebec. Steve Gallinger, who heads the study in Toronto, and I have scratched our heads what to do next. There needs to be some sort of screening. In Toronto, for the time being, they're using a newer form of MRI. We will likely do something to the same extent here. Any patient with an assessed risk of over 5% will be followed You could self-refer yourself to us, and we'll be happy to look after you. It's the association of diabetes with pancreas cancer is fairly loose. It's not a tight association. Sometimes it coincides in new onset of diabetes. But the pancreas cancer would not have been there at a detectable point 5 years ago. It's unlikely that a detectable pancreas cancer was there 5 years ago at the onset of diabetes, even if that preceded pancreas cancer. The question is there a biomarker out there? Is there some sort of a blood test that we could use to detect pancreas cancer? And if we had one and we were to detect it early on at the start of the 10-year period, could we cure it? The answer is likely. We can. If we could detect it, we can. And when we do find premalignant lesions, some of you may have heard the words mucinous tumors or IPMNs, we will resect them. And that is done because we're detecting a premalignant lesion. Some of them carry a risk of up to 40% of having a cancer within them that hasn't manifested yet. There is no test. There is no serum test. And yes, I mean, and that's part of the work we're doing in building, building a Quebec pancreas cancer study where we will collect all of those samples. Somebody had a question. One of the problems with pancreas cancer research is, unfortunately, patients die quickly after their diagnosis. It's hard to recruit patients. It's hard to get those samples. And NIH consensus in 2002 identified that as a priority. And that is work that's been done in Toronto, at Baltimore, and now it's work that will be done here in Montreal. If you're free Monday morning at 9 o'clock, you're welcome to join me in clinic. I'm sure I'll see, Peter and I will see 10 to 20 patients that we're scratching our head and want to find additional hopes for. I don't discourage patients from looking at alternative treatments. At the same time, I think pursuing treatments that have been studied in some sort of a controlled fashion through science is also wise. But we do not discourage our patients. We want to know if they're receiving alternative treatment to make sure that it doesn't interfere with the medical treatment that we're offering them.
It is. There's many things out there. But
Mr. Hishgar, in 2003, he had the approved peronculitic virus. Dr. Bell met with Ottawa.
Yeah, and John was here at McGill for a long time. Thank you. One last question, and we'll stop on there. Thank you.
Why don't you come down so you can share your story with everyone out there?
Don't kill yourself in these days. Students, you know.
Anyways, I'm being followed at St. Luke Hospital right now. Anyways, I've been followed at St. Luke for the last 7 weeks, and I'm going to be taking an aggressive chemo to shrink the tumor, and then we'll consider operating. So besides bringing my count down to 23, I think people who know what I'm talking about have cancer probably. Anyways, the question is that after I bring that number down, I also have to be strong enough to take this aggressive chemo. And I'm not really sure what strong enough means. I've only been able to walk up and down these stairs in the last 2 weeks without losing my breath. So I'm obviously eating better. I'm sleeping better. I've only slept 2 hours a day for 6 weeks. And so sleeping is important. My eating is important. And my exercise is important. But I'm not at the level I was before all this started. So my question is, what does it mean to be strong enough to go through this aggressive chemo?
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I think George should answer that. I can tell you that by
So So part of the clinical examination begins watching the patient walk into the office from the waiting room, and I've just done that, watching you walk up the stairs, and that's pretty good for someone on chemotherapy. So I think overall you look like you're in a reasonably good shape right now, and I hope you continue to be in that shape, and I think you'll be able to see the completion of your treatment. I don't know what the count that you're referring to is. Most of the time we refer to a number called CA19-9. Libby's was quite high, and it dropped significantly with her chemotherapy. Sometimes it doesn't. It's a number. It does not mean anything. His bilirubin. So the bilirubin, if the bilirubin is high, they watch it to go down to make sure that you're healthy enough for chemotherapy. That will drop. They will put a stent in, and that eventually will drop. And then we'll see how you do on chemotherapy usually, and most of the time they're either looking for some shrinkage or at least no further growth.
So we're going to the end of our evening. I'd like again to thank George and Libby for a wonderful evening. You know, I was extremely afraid when we started to put this on the evening at one of our evening. It is a dreadful disease, a dreadful cancer. How can you pass an evening still learn something, not coming out too depressed? I think the two of you have done a fantastic job, and the people asking questions too. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. So give a chance. Oh, I have many people to thank. Please let me thank Marla Schuster, Alita Lebovich, Sheila Notkin, Dale Boyman, Rosalind Goodman, of course, Annette and Joy Ediski, which have been fantastic. Thank you for our guests from Ottawa and from the CRS. Madam Lutterman, we're very happy to have you here, and we'll slowly protect Libby with all the signature. Thank you very much. Have a good evening. Go back home safely. You can give it to me.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
My first
February 25th.
Yes, you bet.
I'm not going to comment on that, but the point. But I think you have to do your own, as much as possible, and then you can.
But what is as much as possible? Because I know.
They may not be able to do it. They may not be able to do it. No, it's reality. Sometimes if you don't have the data.
I have data. I don't have a
But you will definitely.
Need a photocopy of medical records?
No. I think the best thing is to at least make your pedigree. Just put in the father, grandfather, mother, and then see a little X. This one had cancer. This one had cancer.
Yeah, I can do that.
And that you can do. And that's what you bring to him. And then looking at that, it will. See how much
I don't know what
you diagnose. You may, as long as you're relatively sure they have cancer, you can still look.
Yeah,
but that's the best I can tell.
Okay.
So you can also email me if you want to know the condition. But you can search on the genetics, on the.
I'm going to have to clean the stuff up. I mean, I have to use the cart.
Yeah, who's here to clean it?
I'm asking.
Okay, well, give me another 5 or 10 minutes because I... I know people left it. I'm telling you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Conley, just 1 minute. My CD. Where is my CD? That's
the computer.
Can I have it back?
Yes, you can have. You can have that back. In fact, I'm glad that I was leaving without my computer. You're so kind. Yeah, it's good. I just want to say goodbye to my meter. Thank you. But anyway, it was nice to see you and to come. Oh, absolutely. I want your card. I'll give you my card soon because it's not going to be useful, my card anymore. CD. Yeah, that's why you need to.
Really broke it down really simple. I